So, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the New York Historical Society. I'm Louise Miro, New York Historical's president and CEO, and I want to say how thrilled we are to see so many of you in our beautiful Robert H. Smith Auditorium this evening. I greet you on behalf of the chair of our Board of Trustees, Pam Schaffler, and other trustees who have joined us this evening, Chris Dorfler, Bridget Van Kralinger, and Michael Weisberg, and I want to thank all of them for all they do on behalf of New York Historical. I also want to recognize our 2018 History Maker Award winner, who's with us this evening, Jim Dale, the great actor Jim Dale, along with Julie, his wife, Julie Dale. And at the outset, I also want to thank my great colleagues, our museum director, Margie Hofer, our associate curator, Chris Jun, Petru Panaite, and the many, many other colleagues here at New York Historical who made Bill Graham and the rock and roll revolution possible right here in New York City. That's great. I also want to thank and recognize the originators of Bill Graham and the Rock and Roll Revolution, the Skirl Ball Center, and the Bill Graham Memorial Foundation. Yeah. And I want to thank and recognize as well members of the Graham family who have joined us tonight. So just bear with me for a moment as I recognize each one of these friends individually, because they really, truly merit our thanks and recognition. Alex Graham and David Graham, Bill's sons, who've been instrumental to keeping Bill's legacy alive, and from whom you'll hear at the end of the panel discussion. Bob Borsacci, president of the Bill Graham Memorial Foundation and Bill's right-hand man back in the day. Bonnie Simmons, executive director of the Bill Graham Memorial Foundation. Robert Kirshner, the director of the Skirball Museum. Arlene Osejczyk, the art director for Bill Graham Presents for many years. And Rita Gentry, Bill's assistant in the early days of Bill Graham Presents, who went on to work for Santana. And a very special thanks and welcome to Danny Scher for his support of the exhibition. Now, as those of you who have already had a chance to go through the show, you will recognize that unique to our presentation of Bill Graham and the Rock and Roll Revolution is an immersive audio mix of iconic songs that provides a musical tour through the show with songs by Chuck Berry, Tito Puente, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, Aretha Franklin, and many others. The audio experience has been generously sponsored by the luxury audio brand Master and Dynamic, and we thank them from the bottom of our hearts. And I know there are representatives of the company who are with us tonight. The headphones are just amazing. Thank you so very much. So tonight's panel, Fillmore East and the Popular Culture Revolution in New York City, features Jerry Pompili, Amalie Rothschild, Joshua White, and Alan Arkush. Robert Greenfield, the panel's moderator, is the award-winning novelist, playwright, screenwriter, journalist, and co-author of Bill Graham Presents My Life Inside Rock and Out. Though I'm told that his real credential, at least in tonight's context, is that nearly every weekend from August 1968 to March 1970, he attended The Late Show at Fillmore East. Please welcome our panel and Bob Greenfield. Thanks.
Thank you. I hope you feel that way about me when we're done. So our thesis statement tonight is fairly simple. New York City was one way before Fillmore East opened, and then quite another after it closed. To help us prove this point, it's now my great pleasure to introduce our truly blue ribbon panel. And if you'll save your applause until the end, we thank you. He began as an usher at Fillmore East, and then went on to work for the Rolling Stones in England and the south of France. San Francisco, he ran the Winterland Arena and served for several years also as Bill Graham's right-hand man, Jerry Pompili. He was there as a paying customer on the night that Fillmore East opened. Over the course of the next 3 years, as he was studying film with Martin Scorsese at NYU, he became an usher, member of the stage crew, and then the light show as well. He is an award-winning film and television director, Alan Arkush. An extraordinarily gifted artist, video maker, and television director, whose work can be found in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. He is the creator of the iconic Joshua Light Show at Fillmore East, Joshua White. A renowned photographer, as well as an award-winning documentary filmmaker, she was studying for her MFA in film production at NYU when the Fillmore East opened next door. Her book of astonishing photographs of Fillmore East has been reprinted 6 times. Sitting in with us tonight on Clicker, the astonishing images you see behind us are hers. Would you welcome, please, and applaud them all, Amelie Rothschild. Okay, and so we begin. So Jerry, there you were, 1968. Minding your own business, tending bar in a lesbian bar in the village, and
you got in free every late show at the Fillmore East?
I was hoping you weren't going to say that. Thank God Bill is not here to hear this.
Wow, how did that
Jay happen? Benzone, if he's here, the dormant. You're kidding. All right, tell us the story.
You're fired. Okay.
So that's the essence of Fillmore East.
So the Village West was this bar in the West Village, just south of Sheridan Square. And it was one of the many bars in that area. But this one had a pool table. So you can kind of hang out and not have to drink all the time. You can play pool very badly, in my case. And I got to be friendly with the owner, Tony Leck. And he knew there was money in having a gay bar, but he didn't like being around gay men. So he hired a couple of lesbian bartenders and catered to the... That segment of...
Okay, Jerry.
So, okay, I'm getting here.
I've established it was
He was approached by two guys from Stony Brook University, Sandy Perlman, and his cousin, Neil Lewison, who had been putting on shows at Stony Brook and approached him with the idea of doing something in New York at a little theater down on 2nd Avenue called the Anderson Yiddish Theater.
There you go.
On 2nd Avenue, just off 4th Street. And they needed like 15 grand, and Tony went for it. And he asked me to come over and help out by guarding a door, so I went in and guarded a door, and the place was a true shithole, you know? And it was where rock and roll grows, is in shitholes. And it took me about 10 minutes to start running the whole house there, because it was totally disorganized, you know? And Joshua was there at the time.
We're getting there, Jerry, and Bill.
And so I get a call from Tony one time, and he says, this promoter from the West Coast wants to meet. So he sets up a meeting at the Tin Angel, which is the restaurant above the Bitter End on Bleecker Street. And I go with Tony, and we're sitting down, and he orders some soup and stuff, and Bill Graham walks in, right? And Bill's got that big pouch of his, you know, and he takes out all the legal pads with everything written on it. And he goes into this spiel with Tony, who never stops slurping his soup during this entire thing. And he says, you know, I've been doing shows for 3 years now out on the West Coast. I have this relationship with the bands, with the agents, with the managers. I've been to your facility at the Anderson. I really like the way it's run and stuff like that, you know, the whole production stuff and whatever. And I think if we work together, you know, we can really do something. Now, Tony was thinking that Bill was moving in on him, but what was actually happening is Bill was asking Tony to join him because Bill was already... had the whole Fillmore East thing at the Commodore, Lois Commodore, in process. Of course, Tony didn't understand any of this
shit. And his response to Bill was?
And his response to Bill was a cheap Jimmy Cagney impression where he started screaming at Bill, who the fuck are you to come into my town and tell me you're going to be my partner? You can go fuck yourself, go back to San Francisco, whatever. And Bill just looked startled and said, oh, geez, I'm sorry. He packed up his stuff. I shook his hand, you know, and Tony just kept slurping his soup. And Bill walked out.
What did you say to Tony afterwards?
I turned to Tony and I said, Tony, I think you just made a really big mistake.
Okay, so Josh was then already, I hate to say it, with Sandy Perlman, a note, really famous producer, Blue Oyster Cult, great influence.
Clash,
thank you, Alan. Great influence on Patti Smith, a really interesting human being. So Josh was already ensconced in the Anderson. Go ahead. Right?
Did you really see all the light shows at the end of the
week? Yeah. The light shows, where was that?
I didn't have much of a life.
More than I saw, no.
That was good enough, you know?
I was in New York. I'd been out of college for a few years. And I was doing discotheque lighting and fashion shows and industrials, anything involving slides or light. And there was a desperate need for it. We were hired by Bill Graham's company to go up to Toronto to give production support, because Bill Graham, who was then still not nationally known, had been hired by a large modern theater to present a week of shows featuring The Airplane, The Grateful Dead, and a local band. And we gave him really good support, professional theater support, because that was our training. And along with everything else, I had to call the lights, which was not a big deal. It was just changing the wash from red to green, red, green, back to red again. It was simple. But I had to sit in the back of the house on a headset, and I watched these shows, and I was already into the music, but not like this. We were hired to provide a way that the San Francisco light show, which was used to ballrooms, could project their light show in a theater without tying up the whole balcony. And we came up with a rear projection idea that worked. Mm. So we became very friendly with Bill, and I and the people I was working with, we all chose to do light shows from that point on. We would find a place to do them, and we did, and we found places long before Bill came to New York or long before the Anderson.
And then you put him on stage.
Okay.
I'm
afraid to keep going. I don't want to have you know.
No, I wouldn't cut you off, Josh. Right. That's just for Jerry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was really looking around, and it wasn't that big or secret of a community, and I'd heard that Crawdaddy Magazine and these guys wanted to put on shows. And I introduced them to my friends, who Chip Monk and John Morris, who were all people that had been involved with the Canadian production. And we convinced them that they really needed to have a light show. And with the light show, we do the stage lighting, we do everything. And they agreed, and we did. And the only problem in the mix was, as Jerry said, the place was a dump. And the other was Tony, who just didn't get it. I mean, he was just lazy. He was lazy about paying. He was sloppy. He was rude. And Bill Graham, we tried to convince him, really, after the experience in Toronto, come to New York, to New York. Bill Graham, who was, as you know or will know, was a Holocaust survivor who was raised in the Bronx. And he tried everything in New York. He was a waiter in the Catskills. He did everything.
Drove a cab.
And wanted to be an actor and was not a successful actor in New York. But he goes out to San Francisco, a much smaller town. And he was the right person with the right ideas and the chutzpah to pull together what was a very loose scene and make money at it and do it beautifully.
But you put him on stage, right?
I'm getting there. but he wouldn't, even though we're now doing the shows at the Anderson, he wouldn't consider coming to New York. He was afraid. So anyway, but he was in New York, and the light show had a trick that we did. In order to change the bands, we would raise up the screen, the rear projection screen, and there would be six blue lights, which we had determined were okay for the audience to look into. It's called a light curtain. I learned it in theater school. And what it did was it made silhouettes out of everything on stage. You really couldn't see what was happening on stage. And the audience was lit in this very relaxing blue light. And John Morris, just before Janis Joplin went on, brought Bill out on stage where he could see the house. They couldn't see him. He counted the house. And then he changed his mind. And within a week, we were all marching across the street to open the Village Theater that he was going to open in New York. At the very last minute, somebody owned the name Village Theater and threatened to sue. So Bill changed it to Fillmore East.
So this is Alan and Josh and anybody who grew up in the city like I did. Josh brought this up to me, the way music had been presented here before Bill and what I would say is Alan Freed.
Yeah.
And Murray the K, Brooklyn Fox, Brooklyn Paramount, The Paramount.
And Patterson out in Jersey, same thing.
Josh, you want to talk about the nature of those shows?
Sure, sure. We have to accept the premise the 60s began in 1964 when the Beatles came to America to be on the
February 9th.
Why? It's just a few days ago, and so that's when the sensibility changed, and the music was quickly catching up, and everybody was totally involved. But there were still these gatekeepers, the Ed Sullivans and the Dick Clarks,
right,
who framed everything for this mass TV audience, and the disc jockeys who were becoming now popular figures, were putting on these old-fashioned shows, which were the same thing as when Frank Sinatra played, you know, mm-hmm. at the Paramount. Mm-hmm. It would be, you know, this 20 acts on the show, a band that covered everybody. People would do two songs and be off, and it just didn't take the audience or the music seriously. They were capitalistic things, and
it was production.
It was no production.
House lights on all the way.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe a glittery sign and these. I know from performers talking, these were just grinds. You do several shows a day. And it was Murray the K's this or Dick mm-hmm. Clark's that, you know, and that was what it was. Then Bill came to New York.
And I'll say this, and it's because of the people that he mm-hmm. encountered and because of New York, far more than in San Francisco, Bill made rock into theater in New York. All right, so now I'm going to talk to Jerry. Jerry, for those who have only encountered the gentrified Lower East Side, the East Village as we know it today. I wonder if you could tell the people about the Fillmore then and Bill's relationship with the Hells Angels and the local political street gang whom I will colloquially, not a word I use a lot, I will colloquially refer to as the MFers. Go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, so...
call them by their rightful name.
The motherfuckers, thank right, you. Okay. Yeah, we did some things with them which never worked out well.
Well, they wanted the theater, right?
They wanted to use the theater, and we allowed them to use the theater. And when we allowed them to use the theater, they tried to destroy the theater while they were using it, which didn't kind of work out for any of us. And then there was the whole Hell's Angels thing, which felt those motherfuckers, too, thought they were very entitled. And
come in for free. The clubhouse was around the corner.
They thought they could come in for free. And there was the famous incident where one of them, in the confrontation, whacks Bill across the face with a chain. And you never saw guys respond, so they totally freaked themselves out.
Because
Bill just stood there and looked at him with blood coming off his face, and they just shit in their pants. I was standing right next to him, man. It was like bizarre. Were you guys up front when that happened, or you?
I was an usher then.
Bill, yeah, okay.
Bill had like... seen.
But my experience with the motherfuckers, they were a political organization which had a very simple platform. Everything should be free.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they wanted everything for free. And they lived in my building.
Of course, for free.
And it's no joke, they actually murdered the super at one
point. Oh, God.
Oh, God.
And on 4th Street was the Hell's Angels.
The clubhouse, right. Yeah.
And a comment about that is that a lot of the sensibility, the diggers in San Francisco, it was an
different,
interesting
not violent,
sensibility.
Though.
In right. New York, they were just gangsters.
Yeah.
Just modern gangsters. It was not, they were trading on the sensibility.
What was that theater company that we did?
Living Theater.
Right. Yeah. And so they were all weird. Following this something. But when they got to New York, when it came east, it was not the same. It was
okay, so to give you a sense of what it was like on a nightly basis, I'm now going to have Alan tell the I Cantina at the back door story. Alan's guarding the back door, true?
Right, so I started as an usher and then got on the stage crew. And on the stage crew, there was four of us that were stage crew and sort of guarding certain doors and were on the headphones. So there's four positions. One was you were out in the house and people came by you and you checked their pass. One was stage right on headphones, one was stage left, and the back door. And I was also the caterer.
Of course.
And so Friday afternoons, I'd pick up the beer and wine. And this is before contracts, you know. Yeah. So you got before a case writers. Of beer and a case of soda. And cold where cuts. Do you want me to pick up? What kind of sandwiches you want? So I'm at the back door, and all of a sudden, Peter Sunderland, who's in charge of the outside. Group,
he's here tonight, isn't he, Peter?
Is he? Yeah, Peter.
All right.
So Peter is no small man.
Right.
And he comes in and he goes, don't go outside. And you can hear people yelling and there was banging on the steel doors. He goes, don't let anybody out. The motherfuckers are out here and they want to get let in and, you know, is screaming and yelling. And so I take a big steel pipe and I put it across the back door. And at that point, Ike and Tina Turner had been on tour with the Rolling Stones. So they were, this is like now spring of 69, so they were up and coming and had a hit with Rolling Down the River. And they come walking across the stage because they finished and had a great set. So there's Ike in a white fur coat.
Hello. Hello.
There is Tina in a white fur coat. And there's three Ikeettes in a light gray fur coat, all coming towards me. And Ike, who is not a, with a hat, a man not to be denied, anything says, open the door. And I say, Ike is a problem. We've got people outside who want to break in, and it's dangerous out there. And you can hear them banging on the back door. And I said, why don't you walk through the theater? There's just no way he's going to walk through the theater. And he says, open the door. And there's Tina and the Ikeettes, and he says, move aside, and he pulls out a silver pistol with a white handle. And for the sake of this discussion, let's say it matches the fur. And he goes and he steps outside and he fires three shots. Boom, boom, boom. And you can hear footsteps going back. And he comes back in and he goes, Tina, ladies? And then he just looks me in the eye and puts the gun away and says, thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
But I'm sure I remember it.
And they played great. Let's not lose that. All right. They were great.
All right, so I'm about to get, at long last, to Amelie. But before I do, I'm going to set the story up. She's going to tell us because Bill just could not get away with it. I mean, he had a target on his back down there and all these people. And so Frank Barcelona, who was a genius, who more or less invented Rock Agency, and who had bands there every weekend and knew the name of everybody on staff, and Frank was beloved there. I think I'm getting this right. Frank had a Rolls Royce, and God knows why, but he drove down to Fillmore one night and parked it on 2nd Avenue, which I wouldn't do now, okay? And Frank got out of the driver's seat, and all the MFers on the sidewalk said, hey, man, nice car. And Bill got out of the passenger side, Bill, you Graham, you capitalist ripoff, screaming at him, okay? But Bill could not win, and then, Amelie, tell us what Bill did when The Who came to perform Tommy at Fillmore's.
I mean, I even have a picture of, in the men's room, Bill, capitalist pig with dollar signs, et cetera. But, I mean, people who worked with Bill also knew this other charitable side. But it wasn't just charity. He really cared about giving the very best show to the public that he could. And therefore, even if the shows were sold out, he was willing to come up with more money for a better production if his staff gave him a good idea. I mean, and one of the brilliant things about Bill Graham is he understood when he had really good people working for him and gave everyone the encouragement and the support they needed to give to make the best shows possible. And as you alluded to, really the rock music became rock theater at the Fillmore East. It Yep. was the laboratory for the experimentation and the development of the technology that is now standard for the whole industry that developed after that. But when The Who were coming to perform Tommy for the first time in the United States for 6 days running, on a bill with two other opening acts, I went to Josh. I worked with the Joshua Light Show. And I said, listen, Josh, we've got, you know, they're going to do Tommy. We have a libretto. We have the album. We can prepare. I mean, do something that really is theatrical, that's a production that follows the opera. And we need a better light show screen, and we need other effects, and I want to do a movie for Acid Queen. And we put together with Josh and Bob C. and Chris Langhart, who's here, and John Chester, put together a whole proposal, which the guys then took to Bill. After all, I was just the girl with the, at the light show. Times were different. And Bill went for it. The shows were all completely sold out. He did not have to put up a cent. No reason at all, but he believed in what we had proposed, and he put up a $5,000 budget for us to do a special production for Tommy.
A lot of money.
For Tommy.
Okay, and so
which was what?
Which? Well, we built, first of all, we built a new 60-foot wide curved light show screen, and there were flying mats, and I got a $500 budget to film for the Acid Queen, and this is just there. We
have okay, so now stuff. All good intentions yeah. are the road to hell. So, Alan, tell us what happened on the night.
Okay, no, so this was the six nights, right?
Yeah.
Just to set a little context what we're talking about. Tickets were $3, $4, and $5. They went up 50 cents. Bill was a capitalist. Right. For $3.50, $4.50, and $5.50. Here's what you got.
Right.
Miles Davis with the Bitches Brew Band.
Opening for Neil Young.
The second group on the bill, Steve Miller Band. Mm-hmm. The headliner is Neil Young and Crazy Horse.
That's right. Saw that show.
$5.50. Come on. Okay, so.
All right, so thank you, Alan. But tell us about the grocery store.
Okay, so the fire. Mark Spector is here, who was my roommate. And Mark is a fanatic rock fan, and he had the brand new Who 45 Pinball Wizard, which was the first 45 in stereo. And people would come over the apartment and listen to this in stereo because of the big chords. And we got the album that week. And the Who were coming to play at the Fillmore. And they're going to do Tommy for the first time. So all the ushers were all fanatic rock fans. We were desperately trying to get through the whole album once. And so we listen to it. We go to the show. We get all set. And the Who are magnificent. And throughout the show, they're just getting more and more intense during Tommy. But there was smoke in the air. There was just, and we thought, well, that's probably part of the show. And right at the point when they're doing Listening to You, I Get the Music, and it's building, and the audience is building, I go to get someone down front, and I turn, I'm walking back towards the lobby, and there's lots of lights outside that look like fire trucks. And the lobby is full of policemen and people in fire suits. And before I can say anything, and the Who got, now the Who are really getting towards the end of Tommy here, some cop runs right by, plainclothesman runs right by me, clipping my shoulder, and I had the middle aisle, and jumps on the stage. Pete Townsend.
There you go.
Right? Pete Townsend sees someone fighting with Roger Daltrey, who's got the microphone, for the microphone. And on the downbeat, boom! This guy doubles over.
Kicks him
stage
in.
Stage crew drags him out. And now we are in a gladiatorial situation. Everybody stands up, and they're shouting, and they're screaming. And now it's really thick with smoke. They finish. The Who smell blood. They don't see smoke. They go into summertime blues. Gonna raise a fuss. Gonna raise a holler. Right?
So let me stop you for a second. I'm standing outside to get into the late show. I'm across the street. The grocery store in the corner, and Bill always insisted that the guy refused to pay protection. He was being this East Village, being shaken down for money, and he said, I'm not paying. They firebombed the grocery store. I can tell you, I've driven from Brooklyn. I found a parking spot, okay? And I'm standing, and the flames are huge. It's
the flames
weird.
Were going right across Second Avenue. And right across the entire street.
No late show tonight. Go ahead.
So there's so much smoke in the air, and Bill is trying to get Pete Townsend's attention. Good luck with that. And the audience is standing now on the street. On the seats, and Bill comes out on the stage and grabs Roger, and they all come down, and the audience is, you know, and Bill says so calmly, we have a little problem. Across the street, there is a store on fire.
And next to it. It was next in door. The theater. It wasn't across the street.
I know. He totally lied that it was in the building. And he said, let's do this. We'll let you all out.
Nice.
And if there's time, we'll let you back in, and we'll do the late show. So please, the ushers will show you out.
Nice.
The ushers are like, these people are... But the ushers had all grown up in the tri-state area.
Right on.
And had all done a million fire drills.
Right.
And had done duck and cover. You know.
All right, let me.
Somebody says,
go ahead.
It's a fire drill. Everybody grab a buddy, no talking.
Nice. Go ahead, Jerry. Yes.
So normally we could empty the theater in 7 minutes between shows. That's what it took us to normally. That night we were able to do it in about half that time. And while Bill was on stage telling people not to use the front door, I was up in the front lobby with several ushers, keeping the fire department from running in there screaming fire with their axes and stuff, because that's what we didn't need.
Okay, so now let me jump cut.
One of the best rock and roll concerts I ever went to.
Well, yeah, with a fire, yeah. I mean, so now jump cut. So now Bill, I would think, and possibly Frank Barcelona, have made sure that Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend are nowhere to be found. The police are not amused. You do not kick a New York City policeman in the groin on stage and get away with this. So they take Frank down to the station. You want to say something?
I just wanted to say, he was not from the local precinct.
Well, that says everything.
If he had been from the local precinct, it would have been dealt with.
All right, so they're actually sweating Frank to find out where... So this goes on overnight. Bill shows up. They still don't know. Anyway, they finally bring the culprits, Roger, and there they are. God love them. They bring Pete and Roger in, and you know, I can say this. God knows how much money Frank and Bill put down that night. But the story that Roger and Pete tell is, oh, we're working for Bill Graham, and we know he does these things during shows, so we thought these were actors. That he had hired to portray policemen. And then the bill tag is, we got them out. 15 minutes later, they were on stage playing another show, right? They showed up.
They were the single most exciting band I ever saw. And a lot of bands.
Okay, so here's what Bill said about Fillmore East. He said he wanted it to be the white man's Apollo. If you had something to say, get out on that stage and do it. So now we're going to go lightning round, tell a few stories about some of the great bands. I'm going to begin with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, who played six nights in June 1970. And before they came, Bill got the entire staff together and said, look, these are America's Beatles. I want you to treat them with respect. The four greatest nudniks in the history of rock and roll. Yeah, everybody's nodding. I had to have a Persian carpet on stage. No, it's in the wrong place. Move the carpet. The carpet's dirty. Can you please vacuum the carpet?
Vacuum the carpet. John
while
Ford
they're
Newton. Standing there.
Okay, fine.
And no light show.
And no light show. Okay.
And they brought their own sound system.
And the cuisine.
And Noonan's nickname for them.
The Supremes.
The Supremes.
The Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Right. And he called them the Supremes.
And when they came in with their fur coats on, Noonan called them the Supremes.
Okay. So every night before the show, it's Stephen and Neil and David and, you know, Graham, they each had to have a different cuisine.
Yeah.
Not just from a different land, but different from one another. So if Stephen had Japanese, Neil had to have, you know, delicatessen, and they never... ate the food anyway, and encores.
And I would go and get the food.
And they would not
but
eat.
But I hate to say this, it was a blessing that they did so much coke, because I only need to put it, the stage crew ate great.
There you go. So as Bill said, encores were for other people. He couldn't get them to come back out. The crowd was insane. People wouldn't leave. And so one night, it began as a joke, Bill started sliding $100 bills under their dressing room door to get them to come back. Nelia and Kemp saying, more, Bill, more. $800 later, they went out. And so, Alan, the night that, you know who came to see them?
That's, everyone was there. The thing about the Fillmore East late shows was everybody came because the theaters were out, the Broadway shows were over, the opera companies were done. So the Late Show was where everyone showed up, and they all were brought in by Bill. Bill once brought a mezzo-soprano on stage with the Mothers of Invention, and she sang Louie Louie. But on this night, royalty came. Bob Dylan was coming to see Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We couldn't say anything. He went across. He sat in the sound booth. The guys in the band knew this, and they had a section of their show where they would each play like two songs. Solo. And, you know, they were great. But when Steve Stills saw that Dylan was there, he played for 45 minutes. And steam is coming out of everyone's ears. They finish their acoustic thing with one song, and they go back to the dressing room because they have a second set. In that dressing room, they screamed so loud, they actually broke up.
That night.
Between the the first half of the set and the second.
And then they kissed and made up.
They were screaming at each other.
So my other favorite thing about that is at the end of each of these shows, six nights, Stephen Stills would step to the front of the stage, raise his right arm and say, "See you in the street." He would then go right out the side door, get in the limo, go up to his very expensive suite in a Midtown motel. I guess what he meant was, "I'll see you as I'm speeding by you in the street." So, Josh, what the brilliance, and I woke you up?
Yeah, sorry.
The brilliance of this light show, which was mixed media long before anybody understood it, what Josh and his amazing people would do whenever Jefferson Airplane came to town.
Yeah, there was a Bill managed Jefferson Airplane, and in those days, there was like a love-hate relationship between them. He really wanted their appearances in New York to be absolutely amazing. And so we were challenged from early on to come up with some amazing way to bring them on. In terms of performance, they were going to be great, but find a way to introduce them. And one year, we designed a set of an airplane that took off to a sound effect, and it was a wireframe, and it went to the back of the house and then split in half and continued up to the back of the balcony and went to the back of the
house. Which was incredible when you were stoned.
Which is incredible. And when you think that
did it break through a paper screen?
Yes, it broke through a paper screen. But remember, there's no technology. So the way it was done was very kind of Chinese in style. There was 20 people running across the street pulling these cables. But Bill wanted it. But one year, we pulled off an amazing stunt, which was we had found out that you could very cheaply rent these giant motion picture arc lights. And you needed to run them on DC, which was not a problem because the theater was packed with DC. We just plugged them right in. And we showed a film of an airplane taking off that we found from the point of view of the airplane. And then the sound effect that got louder and louder. And then these lights came on from behind the screen, which was so bright you couldn't look at it. I mean, it was blinding. Mm-hmm. And then as the sound was fading away, Bill Graham would introduce the band, and the lights would go off, and the name Jefferson Airplane would be up there. And everybody was totally understood what we were going to do, and it was so simple, except the Jefferson Airplane.
Well, how about King Kong, before you get there?
Okay, yes. Okay. And one of them was that one of the people that worked in our show, John Davison, was able to get us the last few minutes of the film King Kong. So we would show the ending of King Kong, and the very last line of King Kong was...
Airplanes.
Hey, come on, get it together.
It was the beauty killed the beast.
It was beauty
and
that killed
the beast. And it's on their album.
It wasn't the airplane that killed the beast.
It was beauty killed the beast.
And then?
And then Bill would step out in the V-neck sweater, holding the clipboard, and he would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to fly first class, Jefferson Airplane." And then?
They would
be ready.
They would go, "Hey, everybody." And then they turn around and turn.
Like, "Oh, my God, we're playing tonight, right?"
And this, and finally, he just blew up at them on the last show. Said, when I introduce you, with all of that introduction, play. Just play. And they got it. I don't know whether they retained it, but he said... Jefferson Airplane, and they started playing.
They were accustomed to San Francisco.
Just one thing.
Please.
Because you mentioned the film school, someone there. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that everyone who worked in this theater was within 2 or 3 years of each other in age. So it ranged from like 22 to 27, 28. It was part of the film school of NYU. It was five blocks away. The theater school was right next door.
It was next. The graduate program was
next door.
Was adjacent.
Yeah, and the
you were undergrad. I was grad.
Right, and so and you met each other, and you learned from each other because everyone had a common goal. I had never heard of feminism till I met you.
There you go.
And really? She showed me, I remember your student film. And so there was a sense of purpose and getting together and doing stuff at a point in your life when you're not sure what you're going to do next and responsibility. And as a young person of 20, 22 years old, I would see someone like Josh.
Really?
Who was 25 years old.
Yeah. And he seemed to love what he was doing and seemed completely a responsible adult.
Right.
And
which in those days.
And Chip Monk, who was like 28 years old.
And a genius.
A responsible adult did the lighting and Bill. And it was a real inspiration.
Thank
and
you.
So yeah. You can do something. And just to, Josh lent me his Eclair camera to shoot my student film. Mm. Bill Graham lent me the theater to shoot my student film.
There you go.
Yeah.
It was that kind of place.
Yeah. Alan, tell us about the Allmans.
Ah, the Allmans. Okay. Allman Brothers, great band. The stage crew. They were characters.
Cynical. Cynical, to say the least.
Cynical. You had a lot of New Yorkers. You had a lot of attitude. And a lot of show me, because not every band was great. And you had this one guy on the stage crew named John Ford Noonan, who was a very successful playwright, and he liked to stir the pot. And it was Christmas. The headliner was Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Wow.
And there was another group called Appaloosa and an opening act that we had never heard of. That all we saw and knew about this act was the album cover, which showed five really skinny white guys with mushroom tattoos on their legs sitting in a stream naked. Not the stuff New Yorkers really go for. And we get a notice that they are going to be late.
They got
Why
lost.
Are they going to be late? They're still in Boston. They'll be driving down because their road manager had beaten someone almost to death the night before
and was in jail.
And that guy's name was Twiggs.
Twiggs. Yeah.
So they're supposed to be there first. No show. Now, we set up all the other bands, we mop the stage, we paint the stage, we're waiting for them. Usually at 6:30, we finish what we were doing so they could open the house at 7:30 on the button.
Nice.
6 o'clock, a VW, two VW vans, the worst hippie vans you ever saw show up. They got one roadie, his name is Red Dog. Everyone had names like that. Red Dog can't carry in all the equipment. There's Greg. There's Dwayne. Red Dog is the guy next to him.
Okay. He has his finger in his mouth.
Yes.
Okay, so.
And so we now have to carry all their equipment in, and it's all falling apart. It's gaffer taped together. So we set up all this equipment, and they have two drummers. Nobody told us they had two drummers. So now we got two drummers set up, and they open up their guitar cases. And you could see Dwayne's guitar out there. It's a late 50s Les Paul Gibson. Maybe worth $500,000 now.
Maybe.
These are really beautiful guitars for people who look like they're inbred. You know? To us, all right? And they plug in, and we're looking at the watch. And now it's 6:45. And they plug in and count down and go into Statesboro Blues. It's the Allman Brothers Band. Just kicking it. And then the Statesboro Blues, we just look at each other. They go into three other songs. Now doors are opening around the theater. Everyone's coming out of their office like, who are these guys? Like in Butch Cassidy? Who are these guys? They were fantastic. They pack up. I go to their dressing room and say, would you guys like something to eat? And they go, sure. I said, how about deli sandwiches, pastrami? What is that? We've never had pastrami. I said, don't worry, you'll like it. I go get them pastrami sandwiches and their beer. Throughout that weekend, they were rowdy. Blood, Sweat, and Tears family was there from Queens and everything.
Right,
there was a lot of the second night, please stop them from running naked in the halls with the girls. But they played so well that we had a petition. drawn up. And please bring them back.
Okay, so let's, because there's so many stories. So the point is, there's this one iconic night where the late show starts at 2:30 in the morning.
Right. Well, Dwayne liked wine.
Among other things.
Yes, and when they did their live record, I'll just do this that
one. All right, go ahead, yeah. Do that one, too.
They were very happy that they came up to do the live at the Fillmore Elm, which is legendary.
Iconic.
And it hadn't gone well the first two nights, so they asked the light show to perform because we weren't performing. We made a deal to do it for cost. I always made sure they had a jug of wine with their pastrami sandwiches, which they enjoyed. I go to the dressing room to set up in the afternoon, and Red Dog goes by me and goes, oh, Dwayne left a little gift for you in the dressing room. I walk in. Dwayne has bought us two jugs of red wine and left an envelope full of mescaline tabs. And the result, live at the Fillmore East. All right, but you want to know.
Okay,
I'll
just do the setup and you do the close, which is, so the late show starts at 2:30. The Almonds play like on and on and on and on. And Dwayne comes off and says to Bill, hey, Bill, can we play? Bill says, you want to play? Play. I think the light show goes home. I think
everyone stayed. The Dead followed them.
Right, but get to the...
Yeah, so the Dead play. Also, I just have to add that the water cooler was dosed by Osley that night. But you can buy those records. It's Dick's Picks number 4, if you want to hear it.
Or read my book. I know.
And the door opens to the outside. We have been in there since 3 in the afternoon. And now all the encores are done, door opens, and
it has snowed
in New York City. That kind of snow where no one has walked on the sidewalk yet.
And it's been snowing. It's been snowing all the time we were in there.
Yeah.
For 12 hours, and they're playing, and we step out. It was nice when we came in.
Beams of light coming through the doors.
It's 8:30 on Sunday morning.
It was post-apocalyptic.
Everyone's there. Garcia's on the ramp. Everyone's on the ramp. Dwayne walks outside, looks up the street, looks, and comes back and looks at Bill and says, Bill, it's like leaving church.
So it was.
That's why we love Dwayne.
Emily, the Dead?
Yeah. Okay. But you didn't tell me all this. I could have had all these pictures to illustrate all these other stories. The Dead Jam, all of that stuff. But anyway.
You going to tell us about Dark Star?
Yeah.
You want to tell us about Dark Star?
Yeah. Well.
Great story.
There are all kinds of amazing experiences. And the best raconteur for Fillmore East stories is Alan Arkush here. So he's a hard act to follow. but the Dead... First of all, the Dead loved the light show.
Of course.
I have pictures of them with Jerry Garcia's back to the audience standing there watching the light show while he's playing with his back to the crowd. But one of the high points of one of the Dead, by the way, the Dead and the Allman Brothers were the staff's favorite band, hands down. The Dead played like 27 times. I don't know. How many times did the Almonds play?
Well, they came back every 3 months.
Yeah, once they got it. Anyhow, but this particular time, this was one of the highlights, which was set up with the whole stage crew and the lighting guys. And the lights went down. This is the beginning of the set. And the room was completely black. Huh. I mean, and we didn't all, actually, most of us didn't know about this. It was the lighting guys and the Dead and Josh. And the place was black, and you hear the first couple of guitar riff notes of Dark Star, which is very slow. Da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And nobody knows what's going on, or even that the band is on stage. And then as they move into Dark Star, all of a sudden, meanwhile, a mirror ball has been dropped down. And all the Super Trooper stage lights suddenly come on and blast the mirror ball, and it sends complete galaxy of reflected light sparkles all over the entire hall, out of the blue. There was a completely spontaneous gasp from the entire audience. It was magical.
Yeah, because the walls disappeared.
Everything. And I mean, that was
That's how mirror balls are supposed to be used, not what happened in disco and everything else afterwards. But this was really the invention of the mirror ball effect at Fillmore East.
Okay. And everyone was on the headphones and got the cue. Tom Shoesmith of The Light Show, as soon as the audience gasped, he took a slide of a white bird that he had on a mirror.
His Mylar.
And he flew this white bird up the center of the screen, and it looked like it was flying along the dots. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the middle of the set. You can imagine where we went. One more thing about the dead. They were there so often. Mickey Hart's grandparents, we'd set up chairs for them on the stage, and she brought chocolate chip cookies, homemade chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah, what you need to know is that Mickey Hart was a New Yorker. He was the only New Yorker as a member of the Grateful Dead.
I have something to say about the Fillmore East light shows. The Fillmore East light shows were so good that when I finally moved out to San Francisco, I fired all the light shows and put in video projection because they just didn't compare at all. They didn't have the money and the equipment or the talent to, like, do the job.
The audience could not figure out how Josh did it.
No, it was not.
They would say it was pre-made.
Okay, so what I would tell you, and I think it's become apparent in terms of proving that thesis statement, so it was 1,200 capacity, two shows a night, Friday, Saturday.
No.
2,652 seats.
Forgive me.
Maximum capacity, 2,842 standing room. You can see that on the sign in that picture with him.
Okay. And the Anderson was only 1,700. Okay. It was 1,000 less.
But people would come to the Late Show every week and buy the cheapest ticket and hang out in the lobby. Waiting for one of the nice ushers to get him seats.
No, but the reason that the cheapest seats in the last three rows of the balcony sold out first is because everybody could sit up there and smoke weed. Nobody would bother them.
Right.
Okay. So let's Jerry had left. He was with the Stones already. And
I left in the end of December 1969.
Okay. So could you just kind of semi-briefly talk about how the music changed and how the audience changed? And how Bill, who had been getting on the red eye every Thursday night to fly to New York for the Friday show, and then getting on the red eye on Sunday night to fly back and going.
Not every week. There wasn't a pattern to it. But it's true that also the theater operated differently when Bill was in town.
Right. Okay. But he had been spending a lot of time going back and forth. And so how it came to what Emily's going to show us the image here and. To give you a sense of the media value of this occurrence, Bill deciding to close the Fillmore. Go ahead. In New York. Well, that's not the one we're talking about. That's the press conference. What I want you to see is how many, this was every television station, every radio station. This was big news in New York. Go ahead, Alan.
And Bill was giving this speech, and the whole staff was there about what a great show is and what it means so much. And he says, how can I describe a great show? And he says, there's women, and then there's Ava Gardner. And where Ava Gardner? So he said. But
it was his dream woman, always. He was in love with Ava. But tell the folks how it changed. Why was it just the culture had changed?
Everything changed because things change.
Because of Woodstock.
Well, yeah, absolutely because of Woodstock. That's because what happened at Woodstock was... Thank you. What happened at Woodstock was that the potential of this audience and this love was suddenly visible. And it didn't happen right away. It took a few days because there was no film at 11. There was screaming newspaper headlines, hippies mired in a sea of mud. But on Thursday, Life magazine came out with a color spread, which just made this thing look amazing. And then it was just all about everybody sucking up the energy and the legend of getting back to the Garden, thus Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, Taylor, Reeves. The band kept getting bigger before they fell apart.
While drinking and taking seeking all.
They just got so many people, they fell apart.
Oh, and
then the movie comes out, which shows the misery as much as the beauty of it, but the beauty of it was phenomenal. So it was romanticized from that point on, and everything else changed. Nixon had been elected president, the war in Vietnam was getting worse, and the drugs changed. It's always important to just keep in mind that the weed and the acid became cocaine.
And downers.
And I remember Paul Kantner, late Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane, giving me my first, opens a 16-millimeter film can filled with white powder. He says, here, try this. Just sniff it up your nose. And of course, I do a Woody Allen in front of Paul Kantner.
Right? Oh.
Like that. I have never been so humiliated in my life. But the drugs were really changing, and it did affect everybody. And it was not necessarily within the crew, because we were bonded together.
We had to work.
Right. And also the thing about the crew, I just want to say quickly, was they were incredibly intelligent. So what they talked about was about using words like entropy. I mean, they were absolutely connected intellectually, and you could make an analogy.
We would all be on headphones doing a monologue, like a commentary on a movie.
That's right.
The show.
That's
folks,
right.
Folks, if you look to your left.
Thank you very much. It's time to close.
Wait a minute.
Another big round of applause.
The man's trying to take away the music. The man's trying to take away the music.
I have just a couple of quick announcements to make, but before I do, as Louise mentioned, I would love it if Alex and David Graham would come up and say a few words.
Yeah. Nice, huh? Look at the picture behind you.
Okay, I'll be brief. So as you'll come to see in the exhibition, Wolfgang Graunza was born in Berlin in 1931, but Bill Graham, as we know him, or came to him, was actually born here in New York. He chose his name out of a Bronx phone book sometime in the 40s. So in many ways, Bill Graham was actually born here. So to welcome him home, it's really amazing to be here. This exhibition's been going on for 6 years. Thank you so much to the New York Historical Society for having us. Bob Kirshner and the Skirball Cultural Center in LA. Bob was the one who had the faith in us initially and planted the seed that was the genesis for where we are now. Dad, in many ways, was my first teacher. I don't think I learned a lot of the lessons behind what he was trying to teach me until he passed, but victim mentality was something he never succumbed to. He truly saw everyone as an individual. He applied the golden rule in every aspect of his life, and I think whenever he was thrown into a moment of chaos or conflict, he sought out the unifying principles that brought balance and amazing opportunities and joy for many people. I want to thank briefly, some teachers I've had along the way, besides my dad, James Olness and Bob Greenfield, uh-huh, are two people who have helped me not only comprehensively understand who Bill Graham was, but also intuitively have helped me understand the gravity behind many of the decisions that he did and what I should do with my brother, with the archive that went on to become this show. I want to thank Bonnie Simmons and Bob Bersotti from the Bill Graham Foundation and everyone else on the board. They've all been helping us memorialize Dad properly over the past 25 years. I briefly want to acknowledge the great Shelley Lazar, who was a New Yorker, who we lost recently. My godmother, Karen Dotrem, who is my New York mom, we lost her recently. I believe her son may be here tonight. My own mother is here. Hi, Mom. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
And my brother, Chava, and my girlfriend, Patricia. I love you guys very much. And all of my New York friends that have really helped welcome me and seen me as an individual over the past 22 years that I've been here. It's, you know, having a father like this, it's you grow up in quite a shadow. And I've just met so many wonderful people here who've seen me for me and been there for me when times are not so great. Thank you so much for this. And I know how much you know having this here in New York means to me because you've been hearing me talk about it for like 7 years. So thank you. Lastly, I want to acknowledge David's mother, Bonnie McLean, who passed away last week. And in addition to being Dad's first partner in life and being a pillar of Bill Graham Presents, was actually the co-producer of The Greatest Thing Bill Graham Ever Presented, which is my brother David.
Yay!
Who's a total mensch, and I love you, David.
Nice.
Truer words were never spoken.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to echo all of Alex's thanks to the New York Historical Society. It's amazing to be here. Bob Kirshner for originating all of this. An amazing panel. I've been thinking a lot. It's a really amazing trick for our dad to be on a multi-city tour 30 years after his death. Uh-huh. Very impressive.
Right on.
I think I can say for Alex and those of us on the foundation that it was a true honor for us to give to our dad what he gave to all the amazing bands through the years, whether it be the Stones or all the tours. So it's a very serious sense of satisfaction to give him his due reward. I'm obviously here with a very heavy heart this evening. My mother, Bonnie, died last week. Many of you knew her personally. Many of you might know her posters. She created many of the original posters for the Fillmore that are now world famous, and you'll see them in the show tonight. But what I've come to realize that my mom had a sort of an unrealized ownership in the original Fillmore. And I don't mean that literally. I mean that it was clearly a mom and pop organization in the first few years, possibly the coolest one in America at the time. And her fingerprints are obviously all over it. Knowing my mom the way I do, I can see where she was. And I think she always had an incredible pride for that. And I think it was odd for her because she was recognized for the posters, but I don't think people really understood that they did everything together in those first few years. So if you all wouldn't mind, I would love to turn this evening into a celebration for her as well. Yeah.
Right on.
You'll see her in the show. She's that very classy lady smoking a cigarette up against her mural in the Fillmore. And if you can kind of tip your cap to her or tell her her son looks amazing this evening, she would be very grateful. Thank you all for being here. It's an honor to be with you, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Thank you, Alex and David. So I just want to let you know the good news is there is no fire outside. There's no store on fire. However, there is a great party waiting right outside those doors, some food and some drink. But I want you to know when you go into the exhibition, as Louise mentioned, you need to take the headphones to have the fantastic audio experience provided to us by Master and Dynamics. So make sure if you got a time ticket telling you when to go in, try to observe that. Take your headphone, go in, enjoy. And once again, a great round of applause to our panel.
And one last word.
So at the end of each and every one of his shows, Bill would play a certain song to let the audience know that no matter how much they screamed, stomped their feet, and applauded, there would be no more encores. And as Bill said, by the time he closed Fillmore's East and West, he had them all trained like Pavlov's dogs. The audience heard the song, they went home. Please don't go home. Here is that song. I hope. Thank you.
Thank you.